Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, a little bit of a change of plan. I wasn't really due to put out a podcast this week, while I'm still on my fortnightly pattern here. But I do have something I thought worth sharing, and now is the moment to do it, because Easter is virtually upon us. So I thought I would just take the opportunity to share with you the third and final recording I have of a presentation by the Christian philosopher Dr. William Lane Craig. This one being about the events leading up to Jesus' crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. Now, those of you who've listened to the previous two presentations by him that I shared will know that my wife and I went on a tour of Israel with Reasonable Faith, which is the organization headed up by Dr. Craig, and that was back in 2011. And at the end of many of the days there, he would give talks and Q&A sessions back at the hotel. And I recorded some of those, and he gave me permission to post them on the internet. So in more recent times, since I didn't do anything with those recordings nearer the time, I've been editing them up and sharing them here at TMR. So as I say, this is the third one, the final one that I have, and it's a talk about events leading up to Jesus' arrest, crucifixion, burial, and resurrection, a talk which he gave after we had spent the day in Jerusalem itself. It's not quite the whole talk. I have taken out a few things that I thought might come over as rather irrelevant for people who didn't actually go on that tour. Reflecting on things that we'd seen during that day, etc., might seem a little tedious if you weren't there. But most of the talk is there, and it hangs together, I think, as a presentation for anybody to hear. I wanted to say one thing by way of trying to avoid a possible misunderstanding. Throughout the talk, Dr. Craig refers to revisionist scholars or revisionist historians, and I just wanted to say that I don't think that means he's necessarily against any kind of revisionism whatsoever, you know, as if he thinks the traditional position or the official position on any subject is always right, so that any attempt to revise that must be wrong in principle. I think he's using this term in a very specific way to refer to the rather narrowly focused world of biblical scholarship. He argues in favour of a rather traditional interpretation of biblical data, and so he thinks that those who seek to revise our historical understanding of the Bible, at least to a radical extent anyway, that those people are misguided, and especially when it comes to attempts to revise our understanding of Jesus of Nazareth. So that's the way I understand him to be using that term. So having said that, in order to clear up any possible misunderstanding there, here it is. As usual, I've edited out the coughs and sneezes, and I've tried to improve the sound quality for a recording that was made with a built-in microphone on my handheld camera. So not easy to get rid of all those noises. Unfortunately, I've not been able to remove the rumble from the air conditioning altogether. Otherwise, Dr. Craig's voice would sound extremely tinny. So please forgive me, that's still there. Just one thing, there is a break at a certain point. I think it's about 25 minutes in, I think, where there was just a gap between one recording and the next, one file to the next, because this was an old camera. It had a 15-minute limit on it, and I'm afraid his talk went across that divide. So some of what Dr. Craig says is, in fact, missing. So I've just left that as a blank. I think we can get from the context the kind of thing that was missing, so it doesn't detract too much from what he's saying. Anyway, please do be aware of that. Otherwise, if you're not aware of that, it's going to come as a bit of a shock, and I don't want anybody to turn off at that point as if the file's gone wrong. It hasn't. I have deliberately left that gap in there. Anyway, that's enough prologue here today. So here it is, Dr. William Lane Craig on events leading up to Easter, and I hope you enjoy it.
But of course, the Jerusalem that we saw today isn't the Jerusalem of Jesus' day. There are parts of the city that we saw, like Temple Mount or those who went through the tunnels, where you do see first century remains. But the walls of Jerusalem that we see today are medieval. They were built by the Muslim conqueror Suleiman the Magnificent in 1538. He was the longest reigning and 10th sultan of the Ottoman Empire, which was centered in Istanbul, in modern-day Turkey. He reigned from 1520 to 1566, to the time of his death. Suleiman was one of the greatest military conquerors of the Ottoman Empire. He took Islam to the very threshold of Europe. He conquered Belgrade. He took the island of Rhodes. He was at the doorstep of Vienna when he was finally defeated in the Siege of Vienna in 1529 and prevented Europe from becoming part of the Ottoman Empire and a Muslim domain. And it was also Suleiman who restored the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem that we saw today. He built the Jerusalem city walls. He built in the 1520s the Golden Gate and sealed it up so that the Messiah would not be allowed to enter through that gate. So the Jerusalem that we see today, at least in the walls, is largely the creation of this Ottoman ruler, Suleiman the Magnificent. The Jerusalem of Jesus' day lies for the most part buried several meters below the surface. And so although we do see some first century remains in Jerusalem, we need to use our imagination as we look at Jerusalem to try to think of what it would look like in Jesus' day. And I thought the model that we saw of the city at the time of Jesus was extremely helpful in enabling us to envision what it must have looked like then to stand on the Mount of Olives and look across the Kidron Valley at that magnificent Temple Mount and the Jerusalem that Jesus saw. Well, what can we know historically about Jesus and Jerusalem? Revisionist critics today claim that the Gospels are historically inaccurate in so far as they portray Jesus' crucifixion as the result of instigation by the chief priests of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem and then merely carried out by the Roman authorities. The revisionists like to claim instead that ultimately it was the Roman authorities, not the temple priesthood or authorities, who are responsible for Jesus' crucifixion. They point out that during the time of Jesus, there was great unrest in Palestine, and that with hundreds of thousands of visitors in Jerusalem at the time of the Passover, the Roman authorities must have been extremely anxious to maintain the public peace. Nerves, they say, must have been on edge. Extra-biblical sources, such as we read from Philo on Monday night, portray Pilate as a cruel, ruthless man who would not hesitate to bring the soldiers down on the Jewish population in order to keep the order. The temple priesthood of Jesus' day were basically collaborators with Rome who were in cahoots with Pilate in order to keep things under control. Revisionist critics interpret Jesus' act of cleansing the temple as an attack on the temple itself, on the institution of the temple and its authorities. So Jesus wasn't just disturbing the peace, in their view, but rather the Jewish priesthood in the temple felt that their authority was under attack by Jesus' actions. Pilate was about to bring his fist down hard on the civilian population in order to keep the order, and Caiaphas knew that this would have resulted in a great loss of innocent life. And so in order to preserve the peace, and because he felt his own authority threatened by Jesus, Caiaphas decided to deliver Jesus over to the Roman authorities rather than to allow innocent people to be killed in a crackdown by the Roman government. And so the responsibility on the revisionist view for Jesus' crucifixion really lay at the feet of the Roman authorities, not the Jewish authorities, as the Gospels say. Now, what can we say in assessment of this revisionist picture? Well, I think before we look at it in some detail, it's important not to miss the forest for the trees. What's remarkable here, I think, is really the degree of agreement between the revisionist critics and traditional scholars with regard to Jesus' passion and the last week of his life. Even the revisionist critics affirm the historicity of the central events of Jesus' passion. For example, his triumphal entry into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey as a herald of the kingdom of God in fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy. Jesus' disruptive action in the temple, driving out the money changers and their animals. The involvement of the Jewish authorities, in some way at least, in Jesus' hearing or trial before them. Jesus being delivered over to Pontius Pilate on charges of sedition, and Pilate's condemning Jesus to be crucified as a pretended king of the Jews. And I think it's really stunning testimony to the credibility of the gospel narratives that even these radical critics feel compelled by the evidence to admit the historicity of the central events of the last week of Jesus' life. Their main point of contention seems to have to do with whether it was the Jewish authorities ensconced in the temple or the Roman authorities who were chiefly responsible for Jesus' death. Now, some of you might be thinking at this point, who cares? After all, traditionalist and revisionist critics alike agree on the main events. And it's just pointless now, 2,000 years later, to play the blame game. In fact, you might suspect that this whole dispute is really motivated by a little more than political correctness. It's politically incorrect to blame the Jewish authorities for Jesus' crucifixion, and since there aren't any Romans about anymore to complain, it's easy to let the Romans be the fall guy. Well, I agree that there is a good deal of political correctness, I think, that is driving this debate. But if you think that's the whole story, then I think you've seriously underestimated the significance of the issue. There's a lot more at stake here than first meets the eye. What most folks, I think, don't realize is that the revisionist account of Jesus' arrest and crucifixion is just a part of a broader revisionist picture of Jesus of Nazareth, which these skeptical critics are trying to put through. You see, the skeptical critics reject the gospel portrait of Jesus of Nazareth as a man who claimed to be the unique Son of God and the divine Son of Man, and who thought of himself as the promised Jewish Messiah. According to John Dominic Crossan, Jesus was just a kind of social critic, the Jewish equivalent of a Greek cynic philosopher. Marcus Borg, another revisionist critic, says that Jesus was a cross-cultural religious mystic who championed the rights of women and the poor against an oppressive religious establishment. The supernatural Jesus that we read about in the Gospels is just the product of myth and legend. Now, one of the greatest problems with the revisionist portrait of Jesus is the simple fact of his crucifixion. Everybody agrees that Jesus of Nazareth wound up on the cross. In fact, the revisionist critic Paula Fredrickson says that the crucifixion of Jesus is, and I quote, the single strongest fact we have about Jesus. But if Jesus was just a peasant, cynic, philosopher, just a liberal social gadfly, as the revisionists think, then his crucifixion becomes inexplicable. As Professor Leander Keck of Yale University has written, the idea that this Jewish cynic and his dozen hippies with his demeanor and aphorisms was a serious threat to society sounds more like a conceit of alienated academics than sound historical judgment, end quote. John Meyer, a prominent New Testament scholar, is equally direct. He says, and I quote, such a Jesus would threaten no one, just as the university professors who create him threaten no one. The revisionist critics have thus created a Jesus who is incompatible with the one indisputable fact about Jesus of Nazareth, namely his death by crucifixion. And it's in light of this problem that the revisionist accounts of Jesus' passion must be seen. Basically, the revisionist account of Jesus' passion and death is an attempt to explain how you get a non-messianic, non-divine Jesus to the cross, which is where everybody admits he wound up. And the way you do it is this. You imagine a scenario in which there was a hair trigger situation in Jerusalem during Passover that year. The least disturbance could set things off. Pilate is ready to come down and come down hard on anyone disturbing the peace. That's what Jesus did. And so, as I said, that's what got him handed over to the Roman authorities, who crucified him as a public example of what happens to troublemakers. Now, I think that at first blush, we've got to admit this sounds like a plausible scenario. But plausible scenarios must always be assessed by the evidence. And when we ask, what is the evidence for this revisionist scenario, then what's striking is the almost complete lack of any evidence in favor of this scenario. It is based almost entirely on hunches and conjectures about what one would expect to be likely to happen. So, for example, we hear Paula Fredrickson talking about what she, in my historian's imagination, thinks must have happened. John Dominic Crossan says, I can imagine there was a standing order between Pilate and Caiaphas to arrest anyone who got out of line. And so we're treated to all sorts of imaginative scenarios, speculations about tensions in the Passover crowd, about Pilate's thought and his mood, even about what Caiaphas is thinking to himself. Now, this is really quite extraordinary. This isn't the way you do history. If history could be written on the basis of hunches and conjectures, then professional historians would be out of a job. Life is often not neat and tidy. The course of events will often swing in unexpected directions, and people surprise us by sometimes acting out of character in ways seemingly incomprehensible. Now, certainly, imagination does play a role in the historian's reconstruction of the past, but imagination must always be tested by evidence. So, how does the revisionist scenario of Jesus' passion match up to the evidence? Well, not too well, I think. Take, for example, this crucial conjecture of a hair trigger tension in Jerusalem during the time of the Passover feast. So tense that the least disturbance would cause the Roman authorities to come down and slaughter even innocent parties. John Dominic Crossan says anything could cause a revolution. You can imagine Pilate saying, if anything moves, crucify him. But does the evidence bear out that conjecture? Well, to the contrary. Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem in fulfillment of the messianic prophecy of Zechariah, during which he was hailed by the crowds as the coming Jewish Messiah inaugurating the kingdom of David, didn't elicit a peep from the Roman authorities. After looking around, Jesus turns around and walks back out to Bethany, where he spent the night. The next day, he did disrupt the temple commerce, but no Roman troops sprang into action despite his disruption of the temple precincts. No Roman authorities moved to arrest him, nor in the following days did Roman authorities move against Jesus. He continued to teach every day in the temple and to go back out to Bethany to spend the night with his disciples. The idea that the Roman authorities saw in Jesus of Nazareth some sort of a significant threat to the peace so that they would move against him to arrest him simply contradicts their actual behavior. In fact, when you think about it, meddling in Jewish affairs with a popular teacher might actually create more unrest rather than simply leaving him alone, which is what actually they did. Moreover, there's no good reason to think of Jesus' action in the temple as an attack on the temple itself, rather than as what the Gospels portray it, namely as a cleansing or a purifying of the temple. In the days following his action in the temple, Jesus did not speak out against the temple. On the contrary, he continued to teach there daily. And notice that after his death, his followers continued to worship in the temple, just as ordinary Jews did. This was not a rejection of the institution of the temple as such. Well, what about Jesus' arrest? The evidence unanimously supports the conclusion that Jesus was betrayed into the hands of the Jewish authorities, not the Roman authorities. This is not only attested in all four Gospels, but also in extremely early information, which is handed on by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 23. It was, after all, the Jewish authorities, not the Roman authorities, who felt threatened by Jesus' person and teaching, and therefore wanted him dead. Nor was this a last-minute decision that was only reached during Passover week. According to two independent sources, Mark and John, the plot to get rid of Jesus had been brewing among the Jewish leadership for some time. Both the Jewish historian Josephus and the Babylonian Talmud testified to the Jewish authorities' involvement and initiative in Jesus' trial. The Talmud, in Tractate Sanhedrin 43a, justifies their seeking his execution as an appropriate action taken against a heretic. Why is this? Well, at his trial before the Sanhedrin, Jesus was sentenced to death for blasphemy. Let me quote from Mark's account in Mark chapter 14. Then the high priest stood up and asked Jesus, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," said Jesus, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all condemned him as worthy of death. In this saying, Jesus claims to be not only the Messiah, but also the Son of God and the divine human Son of Man prophesied by the prophet Daniel, who will be coming in judgment on the clouds of heaven, virtually a quotation out of Daniel chapter 7. Especially blasphemous in Jewish ears would be his claim to sit at the right hand of God. Now, revisionists don't like this portrait of Jesus. But as Robert Gundry, who is a fine Gospel of Mark scholar, has argued, so subtle an account of a capital blasphemy case in a Jewish setting could not be a later construction. This is an accurate account of Jesus' trial. Now, since the Sanhedrin lacked the authority to carry out capital punishment, the Roman authorities had to be convinced somehow to execute Jesus of Nazareth. And to Roman ears, Jesus claimed to be the king of the Jews would come across as seditious. Remember, at that time, there was no Jewish king in Judea. There were Roman prefects. And so Jesus was therefore cast by the chief priests in the role of a political rebel to Pilate. Revisionists say that the gospel's portrayal of Pilate as a weak and vacillating man contradicts what we know about his ruthless character, as described, for example, by Philo of Alexandria. But I think that the Pilate that we read about in the Gospels is not weak and vacillating. What he exhibits is not weakness, but his characteristic stubbornness in the face of Jewish demands. If Jesus was not arrested by Roman authorities on Roman concerns, but rather was arrested by Jewish initiative on concerns that were primarily Jewish in nature, then Pilate might well resist the temple leaders' efforts to manipulate the Romans into doing away with Jesus. And we know historically that Pilate wasn't afraid to bump heads with the temple authorities, nor afraid to give in when it seemed politic. For example, Josephus tells us that when Pilate arrived in Jerusalem in AD 26 to become the prefect, he deliberately provoked the chief priests by displaying Roman standards with the emperor's image on them in Jerusalem. This was an action which his predecessors have been very careful to avoid, since Jewish religious sensibilities wouldn't permit such images. The Jewish authorities sent a delegation to Pilate, which argued for 5 days to get him to bring down these standards, and he wouldn't do it. On the sixth day, Pilate the Jewish crowd, and then upon signal to unsheath their swords. And at that point, the Jewish delegates bared their necks, saying that they would rather die than violate Jewish law. Whereupon Pilate, realizing that he was on the verge of provoking an uprising, gave in and ordered the standards to be taken down. Now, Pilate's action just 4 years later, in the case of Jesus of Nazareth, follows this same precedent. He stubbornly locks horns with the Jewish leadership until he sees that a riot is about to break out, when the chief priests make the thinly veiled threat: if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Then Pilate realizes where his self-interests lie, and he relents and gives them what they want and orders Jesus to be executed. But by giving the crowd a voice in choosing between Barabbas and Jesus, Pilate ensures that the people will not rise up on behalf of Jesus. They have what they want. Revisionists will sometimes say that the crowd's calling for the release of Barabbas is inconsistent with Jesus' popularity. They wouldn't prefer Barabbas. But we don't really know how many sympathizers Jesus had in Jerusalem, nor do we know which people the chief priests had selectively assembled that day to appear before Pilate. And in any case, frankly, Jesus must have appeared something of a disappointment to those who had hailed his triumphal entry earlier in the week and had expected him to take up the throne of David. He hadn't followed up on his triumphal entry or his cleansing of the temple by calling for a Jewish insurrection. On the contrary, in answer to the provocative question about paying taxes to Caesar, Jesus had given the positively anti-revolutionary response: render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Mark 12:17. The bloody and broken image of Jesus, which was presented by Pilate to the crowds, was the very antithesis of the conquering warrior king and Jewish Messiah that they had learned to expect. And it's not at all improbable that Barabbas, the insurrectionist, appeared to them to be a more honest-to-goodness Messiah than did Jesus of Nazareth. Traditionalists and revisionists alike agree that Jesus was then crucified by Roman authority. But what happened to Jesus' body after his death? When I was approached by NBC about being interviewed for a program entitled The Last Days of Jesus, I said that I would do it so long as they would talk about the resurrection of Jesus. But when the producer said, no, we're just going to end the story with the crucifixion, I said to her, well, then you're not really going to be talking about the last days of Jesus, are you? And she said, I see what you mean. If it hadn't been for the resurrection, nobody would really care about the last days of Jesus, would they? Well, that's absolutely right. The resurrection of Jesus is the key to his identity. So, what happened then to Jesus' corpse? John Dominic Crossan surmises that it was probably taken down by the Roman soldiers and thrown into a shallow dirt grave where it either rotted away or was dug up and eaten by dogs. But not only is there no evidence at all for this colorful conjecture, but Jewish burial practices and sensibilities are in direct contradiction to it. In opposition to Crossan's conjecture, let me just summarize four facts which are agreed upon by the majority of New Testament scholars who have studied this question. And I'm sure that those of you who know my work could recite these four facts yourself. Fact number one, after his crucifixion, Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea in a tomb. And this fact is highly significant because it means that the burial location of Jesus' body was known in Jerusalem to both Jew and Christian alike. And therefore, any movement in Jerusalem based on belief in the resurrection of the dead man would have been impossible in the face of a tomb containing his corpse. According to John A.T. Robinson of Cambridge University, the honorable burial of Jesus is, and I quote, one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus, end quote. Fact number two, on the Sunday morning following his crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. According to Jakob Kramer, who was an Austrian specialist in resurrection studies, and I quote, by far most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb. As D.H. Van Dalen puts it, it is extremely difficult to object to the empty tomb on historical grounds. He says those who deny it do so on the basis of theological or philosophical assumptions. Fact number three, on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people saw appearances of Jesus alive after his death. This fact is virtually universally acknowledged by New Testament scholars today. Even Gerhard Ludemann, who is perhaps the most prominent critic of the resurrection today, admits, and I quote, it may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ, end quote. And finally, fact number four, the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite having every predisposition to the contrary. Despite every predisposition to the contrary, it is an indisputable fact of history that the original disciples believed in, proclaimed, and were willing to die for the truth of Jesus' resurrection. C.F.D. Mole of Cambridge University concludes that we have here a belief which nothing in terms of prior historical influences can account for apart from the resurrection itself. So, any responsible historian then who wants to give an account of the fate of Jesus of Nazareth must deal with these four independently established facts: the honorable burial of Jesus in the tomb, the discovery of his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, and the very origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection from the dead. And I want to emphasize that these are not just the conclusions of conservative or evangelical scholars. This represents the majority view of mainstream New Testament historical scholarship today. So, the question is, how do you best explain these facts? Well, here the skeptical critic finds himself in a rather desperate situation. For example, a few years ago, I had a debate at the University of California, Irvine, with a professor who had written his doctoral dissertation on the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Now, he was thoroughly familiar with the evidence, and he could not deny the facts of Jesus' honorable burial, the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. And so his only recourse was to come up with some alternative explanation of these four facts. And so he argued that Jesus of Nazareth must have had an identical twin brother who was separated from him shortly after birth, who grew up independently and happened to come back to Jerusalem just at the time of the crucifixion. He stole his brother's body out of the grave and presented himself to the disciples, who mistakenly thought it was Jesus risen from the dead. Now, I'm not going to go into how I went about refuting this theory, but let me just say that I think it's so instructive because it shows what desperate lengths skepticism must go to in order to explain away the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. In fact, did you know that the evidence is so good that one of the world's leading Jewish theologians, Pincus Lapid, who taught at Hebrew University in Tel Aviv, declared himself convinced on the basis of the evidence that the God of Israel raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. So, in summary then tonight, the evidence doesn't support the views of the revisionist historians. On the contrary, I think we have solid historical grounds that Jesus of Nazareth not only claimed to be the Jewish Messiah and the divine Son of Man and the unique Son of God, claims which provoked his arrest by the Jewish authorities and ultimately led to his crucifixion, but also I think we have evidence that those claims are true because God raised him from the dead. As the early apostles preached, God would not allow his Holy One to see corruption. God has acted in history and left an empty tomb as a trophy of his victory.
Amen.
The recording included in this podcast is copyright reasonablefaith.org 2011 and used here with kind permission.